Oh, so we're already live?
We are live. So I just wanted to.
Oh, well, hello, everybody. I'm not good, so.
That's the first
I was all set to start this with a glass of wine and salute Lisa and Carolyn and say happy actual publication day, even though Lisa had an event last night. So if you're watching this, you could send us a reply. Are you willing to come live or are you just going to stay home for now?
That's actually a good way of doing it. Do people want live events back or do they prefer the streaming?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Too funny. So, all right. So let's start formally as though we really were engaged here. And let me present to you One Step Too Far, which is a fabulous thriller and its sequel to last year's Frankie Elkin book, which I thought was marvelous. And I'm trying to remember, Lisa, did you actually intend to write more than one Frankie Elkin, or did everybody so much fall in love with Frankie you couldn't resist?
I have no intentions, so it all just kind of happens.
That's what I thought. I mean, I thought we had a discussion about she was going to be a standalone, so amazingly, here she is.
And
well,
now we have this book, and it makes sense at the time, too.
Well, Carolyn's the one who's really going to be talking to you, but I will butt in as, you know, as I intend to do from time to time. Lisa has very kindly signed many copies of this wonderful book, and they are somewhere between her home and the poison pen, probably to land tomorrow. So while we still have some, I really encourage you to order copies. And we had the privilege of talking to Carolyn last April when her most recent amazing book came out. So it's really fun to see you again, Carolyn. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara.
Right. So are you all ready with a polished performance and all, or do you want me to wander in and out? What would you like?
You're welcome to join, right? Like anytime. Yeah, you wanna.
Well, I have one question and then I'll cede the floor to you here for a minute. But Lisa, I've known you for a long time. You're a real health person, you know, you're an outdoor person, all the rest of it. How do you know so much about how alcoholics must feel and try to function?
You know, I thought that was an important part when I went to develop Frankie Elkin. And I'll be honest, it was one of my regrets in some of my earlier novels. I think often in thrillers, we use the alcoholic, burnt out cop, whatnot, as a trope. You know, we don't really talk about the true nature of the disease. And over the years, I've gotten so much mail on the subject of people saying, look, you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic and, you know, you did every cliche there was. And that bothers me because I want to get the story right. And I think one of the best parts of a reading experience is walking in someone else's shoes. So I made a very conscious effort when I started with Frankie that the alcoholism couldn't be, you know, a cliche. It actually is one of the driving forces for Frankie. She keeps leading her crazy life of investigating cases that she has no reason to investigate, not have a town and not have a home, not have a real job. It keeps her sober. And so a lot of very nice people were very candid and shared a lot with me. And I'm very grateful. And I hope that for people who read this book, it seems authentic and truthful for what it's really
and
like.
Painful. I mean, her every single day is so painful, you know, in trying to deal with it. I once had a stepson in a previous marriage. And now I have, you know, the good husband to whom I've been married for 32 years, but I had a more difficult one. And I can remember that he was addicted to drugs, I believe it was, and substituted born-again Christianity for that addiction. And, you know, that became a way of, he didn't get over being addicted, he transferred the addiction to something else that would give his life meaning and wouldn't torpedo it in the same way that, and that is, seems to me what you're doing with Frankie, is that she has taken on this role of finding missing people as an addiction that allows her to deal with her more destructive addiction, which is alcoholism. And that's just my reading of it, but I wondered if that's the way you intended it.
She has an addict's personality. And so she's very much trying to take those same traits that kind of have made her an alcoholic, but can she use them for good? Because she doesn't want to drink, but she's obsessive, she's impulsive, she's very restless. She talks about it a lot, she can't settle. And
there's a moment in this book when she opens a door where you know that a lot of normal or well-adjusted people would not. And I loved that moment because to me, that crystallized it was that in action, like, yes, this is part of why she's good at what she does, but also part of why she's at risk.
Exactly. Very well said. Thank you very much, Carolyn.
So I'm going to take my glass of wine and my non-addiction personality and just sit back here.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. It's such an honor to be here. The You Trilogy is one of my favorites because it's one of those great ones where you don't know what to think of the characters. I mean, well, the main character, really. I mean, he is so compelling, but yes, you managed to write a serial killer that somehow, you know, it gets us all thinking, though, like in his head all the time. And I love what you're saying about, you know, all the obsessive choices. There's choices, 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 choices. And he just, you can't let him go, but at the same time, you're like, oh, this is wrong. And that is my favorite kind of reading experience. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Alive, like you've done, I mean, you've kept so many people alive for so many books. So I'm so like, I saw a video you did a year ago. I sound like Joe now, but where you were talking about how like you'd finished the research and you were starting this one and how you didn't, yeah, like Barbara just said, you didn't mean, you thought you were writing a standalone. So I'm so curious about that moment that you were like, oh no, like Frankie is, you know, one of mine. We're in this.
So I'm an avid hiker, as many people know, and Barbara was talking about, and I live in the mountains of New Hampshire. So certainly during the pandemic, if I wasn't hiking a lot before, I started hiking all the time, like a lot of people did. And as part of being more backcountry and getting way off the beaten path, I felt it was important to take a survival class, wilderness survival. And that was so cool. I mean, basically you're playing with fire and knives, and if you're a writer at all, how could you not use that? But also as part of it, you start learning the statistics. 1,600 people are missing on our national public lands, like our national parks, and no one's even looking for them. And I kind of live in some of, you know, I live on the edges of some of these places. And that dynamic that you can have this whole population, it's not really tracked. No one's really sure of the jurisdiction. And when a hiker goes missing, if a toddler runs away, wanders away from a campfire, you get all of those volunteers in the beginning. And it's great and it's phenomenal, the people who will come out and give their time. But the volunteers, they have to go back to their real life. You know, so 3, 6, 12 weeks later, they're gone. And that vacuum, those families that don't have answers, they're still desperate for answers. It was so compelling to me. And then clearly, well, I mean, this is what Frankie Elkin does, right? We established this, and before she disappeared, she works the cases that fall through the cracks. And the people that go missing in our woods are many, or, you know, a couple thousand cases that fall through the cracks.
Yes, and so many. So how do you like, how do you know where to go next? Like, because that, this felt like the right book after the first one. And that's where I was like, yes, this is like the opposite, especially because going back to the alcoholism, so much of the first book was Frankie working in a bar. And I like that you address that in this one. Like, we know that that's been her coping, but it was so exciting to me to see her go in where there's no alcohol and have all those moments. Like, was that part of your, ooh, the woods, like I can take that temptation away on a daily, like just while she's in there, that it's not, you know, she doesn't get to be near it, smell it, see it. And that heightened the sense memories that she has for me. Like,
I suspect I'm just as evil to my characters as you are to yours. I was more like, Frankie should not be in the woods. Frankie, we've kind of established she does urban inner cities, tenement housing. Like, what the hell is she going to do in remote Wyoming wilderness? And then I thought, so of course she has to do it now, because kind of fish out of water. And how interesting and how absolutely terrifying for her will that be?
Yes, no, when they're eating the steak, when they're in the restaurant, I love food scenes. And I just felt all that food and saw it. And I'm like, you're sitting in a booth and it's nice. Like, don't go. You can still back out.
I think Frankie is one of the first characters I've ever written in all of these years where, I mean, I don't really know everything about her. I mean, she's driven by this question. And I think the central question is just, who is Frankie Elkin? I mean, who the hell does this? Goes from town to town. And I mean, we know she's obsessive. We know she's a dry drunk, essentially. But there comes, I think, kind of a poignant moment in One Step Too Far, where she's way in the middle of the woods and things are going south. The search party, bad things are happening. And even there, like, why the hell are you here? You're not a hiker. You're not a searcher. You don't know the missing hiker. Why are you doing this? And she just has to believe there is a reason for her to do it. It can't just be because she's a dry drunk. She really wants to believe there's more to her, but she's not sure either. I think she's like the rest of us. She's just trying to figure it out.
I think that's why it works, because that's when I loved her the most, when she'd have those thoughts and then kind of like shrug and go talk to someone and then talk about listening. How like the listening does become this superpower.
Yeah.
When she first gets out there, I'm like, oh, these guys, these jerks, like for these people. And then as it goes on, you know.
Yeah, you have your poor Frankie. So it's a search party of eight, head into the remote Wyoming wilderness. I called it, you know, Agatha Christie's, and then there were none, goes for a hike. So that's the premise. We have a young man, Timothy O'Day, who's been missing for 5 years. This is a last ditch attempt, you know, being run by his father, who's a very angry man, we established. And then you have the three incredibly guilt-stricken buddies that were with Tim the infamous weekend he went missing. And, you know, their guide, their, you know, the erstwhile, the man who's of the mountains. And they have like Bigfoot Bob and Frankie and one other woman. And it's such a testosterone fest. So if like Frankie didn't feel uncomfortable enough already, was she's hiking, she has to set up a tent. She's never set up a tent. She's normally asking neighbors and stuff questions about why someone went missing. Hiker lost in the wood. I mean, does she grill the grizzly bears? I mean, what is she? There's so many things she just doesn't know how to do. And it's
including, I like the magic trick of like, we know that like she's like that. She's, I feel like you've said before that how she's allergic to having a home. And yeah. I like that when you think of that kind of expedition, well, you don't have a choice. Like I felt it when they made that campsite, like, oh, this isn't her. This isn't how she likes it. That like every night she knows she's going to sleep near with these people around in a family with them. And that's right. And I loved Daisy.
Aw, Daisy and, the search dog, my favorite.
Yeah, but even that, I'm like, oh, Lucy got it. Like, so she's got a dog. I'm like, that contributed for me, for Frankie feeling like she didn't know what she was bringing to the table. When like Luciana is bringing something so specific. Proven.
I mean, Frankie's the odd person out. And it's interesting because that also plays into her alcoholism or why as a recovering alcoholic, she can do this. You know, so many addicts talk about, you know, even with the people they love, even in a crowded room, they feel alone. And so Frankie is somewhat like kind of leaning into that emotion. I mean, she is with seven strangers and her life is in their hands. Their lives are in her hands. When you get out that remote, there's no cell signals, there's no satellite radio, there's no one to call for help. But again, she's the odd one out. She doesn't have the experience, she's not the father, she's not the groomsman, she's not the somewhat professionals that are there. But again, her logic being, I always feel like the odd man out. At least this time there's a reason. So she's kind of leaning into it.
You know? Yes, and I like
taking that. I think she is too. Could I just add something, you know, because I think, you know, as we all grow older, we recognize that we become invisible women. But here's Frankie, who needs to have some purpose in life. But she's you know, middle-aged. She has no real professional training. She doesn't have any particular family or wealth or whatever. You're basically forcing her to create some kind of a role for herself, some kind of a mission, profession, if you want to call it. If she's going to survive her own life, if she's not just going to stay, you know, an alcoholic. But it's not like she can go somewhere and get a job. She really has to create something for herself. And because this is a field, as you point out, where there are missing people and nobody's looking for them, it's a vacuum that she can step into without people turfing her out because she doesn't have credentials or she's not educated for the part. And she doesn't also have anybody nagging her about her safety. She doesn't have children, you know, that are saying, but mom, you know, I mean, it's a perfect thing for her. I think you've really been brilliant in creating basically a career for somebody that doesn't have any qualifications for much in life except drinking.
Yeah.
Well, so I have to say, Frankie's partly is inspired by real life. In real life, people are starting to do this, which I think is pretty phenomenal, like everyday people wanting to
work. You mean looking for people?
Yeah, cold cases, particularly cold cases, missing persons, even cold cases, murder. I mean, it's one of those things, if forensics was going to solve a cold case, it would have happened. If the police had the right witness or the lead, it would have happened. So almost by definition, that is the vacuum for, it's the right person asking the right questions at the right times. And actually, so that piece of Frankie I got from real life and her trying to deal with addiction and being a recovering alcoholic, I did a lot of research for. But the rest of Frankie kind of just, becomes the question I'm writing to find the answer with. And I have to admit, because I have you here, Caroline, I want to know the development of Joe. I mean, stalkers are real, lots of things are real, but how much did you know and how much do you just let the characters write the book for you?
Yeah, I mean, I thought about this because I loved the dad story, the camping, yeah, like, and the unfolding of that. And I was curious, I'm sorry, I'm doing that thing, I'm going back to you. But like, did you know that story going into this, or did that, once you got her in the woods and once the story's going, were you kind of thinking of that in detail and about when to reveal it and tell that story about the backyard?
Well, one thing I do, and I'm gonna guess you and I might be similar in this regard, is every character has to be a little bit good, a little bit bad, because the truth is I don't actually know the ending. And One Step Too Far was actually one of my bigger challenges, because there was only 8 people. So already I have, like, you know, the set cast. One of these people, you know, when bad things start happening, you know, they start looking at each other. You know, someone here we should be afraid of. Some of these people have to have bad things happen to them, but I don't know what. So it's like everyone has to have, the reader's got to be able to see go either way. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of show up each morning to write, to figure out the answers to this. So, I mean, do you plot? Do you plan?
Yeah, no, I relate to that. I feel like I make a plan. It's almost like going to the grocery store or Target. Like, I need these 4 things. So then you get into the aisle and, you know, and a lot of times I find, like, I'm only writing, you know, I just finished my 4th Joe book, like a draft of it. Yeah. But one thing is, I go on, I'm like, oh, right, like, it's okay to have an image of something or to want something and not know why. And I'm trying to get more comfortable with, like, yeah, I'll figure it out or I'll cut it.
Yeah.
Like, you have those things in your head that you're doing, like, not sure why I'm doing this, but it's there. And yes. And some things that you never know. Like, in my first book, it was just this green pillow. And I'm like, I don't know, I just saw it. And to this day, I'm like, not sure where. Like, we used to have a green sofa where I grew up, but, yeah, like, you know, not that. But yeah, with him, it's like, I'll think of the situation sometimes and then step back and see his whole life and then think about some part of his life I haven't thought about. And I think that's what I felt here with, like, Frankie. It was like when that story was slowly bubbling out of her and it was like, ah, you know, it felt like I could feel it bubbling out of you.
I like the magic of it. I mean, I think for us as novelists, these are kind of the magic moments where you have this instinct for something. I mean, we do research. I mean, I have a vague sense of certain things should happen because it's a thriller. So, you know, something dangerous should happen. Something bad should go wrong. There's a problem that should be solved, but yet not solved, so that there's another problem, because, you know, we do have 100,000 words, here you go.
But right,
within all of that, you get these moments. Mm-hmm. I think this needs to be, or, ooh, this feels right. And then when it all kind of comes together, that's what keeps me coming back to the keyboard.
Like, yes.
That moment, it's magic.
Yeah. And when I realize, like, I feel like when I'm struggling with something and I am like, I take Joe out of the equation and think of this person in their life without him and how they are and what about them, like, enables them to be a certain way that he might not see it that way, but that is the reason they are the way they are. That is the reason he is the way he is. And I felt that in this book, just like, I like the loneliness of her kind of asking people, like, how do you live life? Kind of, you know, like, on a bit, like, I like that dynamic so much in this claustrophobic, wide open setting, that combination. And there was something very, like, childlike about it that was really sweet to me. And yet also so, like, badass brave, you know? So I like those combinations. And yeah.
Like, one of my mantras when I'm writing, particularly suspense, because I think so much of suspense is plot driven. You know, there's a mystery. We want the mystery. Yep. Something terrible happened in the woods of Wyoming 5 years ago. And, you know, there's a grieving father, a dying mom, these poor groomsmen who are kind of assholes when you first meet them. And then Frankie starts to realize their whole lives stopped 5 years ago. They've just never recovered. So you need, you know, the central problem, crime, that's going to drive the action. But I kind of feel my mantra when I'm writing suspense is, none of this works if you don't care. Mm. You have to start becoming invested. So I don't know all the answers to the characters when I start, but I felt like for each of the 8 people on this trip, they had to have a story, and they're probably going to be imperfect people because that makes the most sense anyway. But there has to be some reason for us as a reader to care about them. Or really, at the end of the day, if 8 people walk into the woods of Wyoming and bad things happen, you know, you know, but once you start understanding what's driving them and you care about the guy's guilt and that they've not gotten on, you feel Martin, the father's just,
oh my God. Great. Yeah.
And he's not the nicest guy. I think he kind of wins king of the assholes. But once Frankie realizes, I mean, he's so used to having the answers, and he's the one who taught his son to hike, and just his helplessness is what is just driving this incredible obsessive rage. And, you know, obsessive is something Frankie's pretty good at.
And also that she has that patience with assholes. Like, I liked that. Like, so many times I'm like, I would march back down. Like, I would just be like, Louisiana, let's get out of here. Like, these assholes, like, you know, it's over. But then Bob, like, where did he come from? Like, is he kind of loosely inspired by someone? He's just, I don't know, just like so warm and good. And
yes, yeah, so we have, you know, the guide, the father, the strange groomsman, Louisiana, the dog handler, Frankie, and our last contestant here is Bigfoot Bob. And this was one of those things I didn't know. But when you start researching all these missing persons cases on national public lands, they call it, one of the first things that comes up is there's no database. There's no government organization that's tracking this. There was supposed to be, but it's not really happened. So these cases end up kind of falling through the cracks of, are they federal, are they county, are they state? So in fact, to date, the best working knowledge we have on the nationwide picture of missing persons cases comes from the North American Bigfoot, a society, association, something like that. They're interested in anomalies. They spend a lot of time in the woods, and particularly like if you're in the Olympic Peninsula, they've worked a lot of the major missing persons cases. And to the extent they're out in the woods, they're still looking for some of these missing hikers, because closure always matters to the family. And that just, I thought that was kind of powerful and quirky and all the things you love to do. Yeah,
anytime you're looking for a missing person, it's kind of like looking for Bigfoot, because we all know that you're probably not going to find them. That, like, we all want closure, but like, you're probably not going to meet Bigfoot. You're probably not going to find the missing person. And yeah. I like the crossover there. And I love that that's real. That would have been, I bet that research moment was just bliss. One of those when you're like, yes, the world is on my side.
Yeah. How much do you research your books? Because I like getting some basics and I like those moments. It's kind of like, again, with the magic of writing, when you learn the thing you didn't even know you didn't know.
Yes.
I mean, you're moving around. You have a lot going on in your books. How much of it?
Yeah, I like to go way in there and then go through that phase of like, I'm going to write it all. It's all going in there. And then be like, okay, like step back. It's kind of like being, you know, a kid when you, you know, you get a Barbie and that's it. And there's no other toys. And you're like, all right, like now I got to like calm down and like do other things. But yeah, I like to know more than one. I like to feel like I know more than what I'm writing about. I don't always feel that way, but I'm like, that's the goal. And then
when you sit down to write, can you correct yourself as you go? Because I have to do like way too much. And then just sit there and cut it back out? Or can you police yourself? Are you the student I already envy right now is what I want to know.
No, I write really long and like just all in there. And I feel like every time when I look at my books of the past, I'm like, oh, like cut, you know, like that's too much. Or
Do you have a cut folder? I have an entire cut folder.
I have so many. And do you tell yourself, well, I'm sure, like, so how is it? Well, I'm like, do you feel like now that you're doing another Frankie book, right?
You know, I've never used anything from the cut folder.
I know, delete. But that's what I was going to get.
Yeah, I can't delete because that like breaks your heart. It's like, yes. I spent 5 days on that just to realize, oh, I needed a sentence, which just, it also makes you beat your head against blank the computer screen for a while too. But so.
Yes, and like, and I can't, you can't delete those files because they're always going to go in the next.
Yeah. So the cut folder, I feel like, is our psychological trick for letting go without really letting go. But yeah. I've never pulled anything back out, almost inevitably, sadly, that was meant to be cut.
Mm. Yes. Well, that's a good way to feel, right?
No, I still regret the 5 days, 6 days. At this point, cumulatively, I'm sure there's like a year of my life.
No, it's like the book that's not in the book. It's a strange thing about publication day. You were like, "What? Now, wait, what's in here?" Yeah, it's like, how did it end up?
So I rewrite as I go
because
I don't know what I'm doing. Then at the end, I do a major revision with my editor. And then even then, it's nice to have some cold readers because I have like so many versions of the book in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes can't remember what you actually is there now versus what you used to. I mean, what's your editing process like?
So my mom will read as I'm writing, like I'll write a few pages and be like, this is it. And you're my mom. Like, love me. Tell me it's great. And she'll say, like, I love the writing, but she'll always have some line that irritates me and that brings out the brat in me. And then the next day or an hour later, I'm like, okay, thank you. Like, you're right. Like, that didn't, I didn't get why she was acting that way. And now I have to, there's that initial bark, you know. Do you wait until you have it all? How do you like show people when you have a whole draft? Or
with my editor, I'll do like the first half and then the whole book. My mom is one of my cold readers. It has to be the whole book. She's a huge reader. My family likes to read. And then it's very funny because she just hates fragments and run-on sentences. So inevitably it's a lot of, you know, this is not a sentence here. I'm like, it sounds good. She's like, no. I was like, it's colloquial. I mean, we've been at this for like 30 years now. She's still like, that does not. They keep us, you know, honest.
Yes. And then you're like, that's, she's allowed to like what she likes. And so on she can go. Yes.
Now she tells me things like, I'm going to make a comment and I already know you're not going to like it. And I'm like, wait, now I'm already angry and defensive and we still haven't gotten to the comment.
Yeah, no, my mom does the thing. It was great. And the voice upticks. And I'm like, no, just say. She's like, no, it was great. I loved all of it. I'm like, just say, you know. And then, well, yeah.
But this is the security, right? So now that, you know, today is the pub day. For one step too far and is out in the world. And at least so many people have already gone through it and tried to beat it up, thankfully, that you feel like, okay, my child is at their best and brightest out here for the general public. They've only knew the pain and anguish that went on behind the scenes.
I'm the same way. I'm like, once it's out in the world, I think that's, I mean, like, well, you've written about series and had to keep everything straight. That sometimes I forget, oh, everyone read those other ones, because I'll think, oh, this happened. And then I'm like, nope, didn't. Like, that's the thing of publishing books about the same person over and over again. Like, you got to know everything they've been through and done. And yeah.
So, do you keep track from the beginning? Because, okay, before she disappeared last year, Frankie Elkin was supposed to be, as Barbara said, a one-off. Well, then I ran across the scenario where, okay, this should be her again. But now I have to go, like, start making the cheat sheet. Because I didn't necessarily pay attention as much as I could have. Like, you know, what's your character's eye color? These are things you want to get right in the next novel. So, but I feel like I'm always backing my way into the official like cheat sheet. Do you know advance, or do you have to like, oh, whoops, I do have to keep track of this now?
Yeah, I mean, I guess with the first one, while I was writing the first one, I wanted to do another and I kind of went directly into it. Then time went by and they started making a TV show, which we'll get to that soon, but congratulations on, you know, your TV show. And then when I went back to it, I was so far away from it. And I looked at it and looked at like someone else's interpretation of it.
Well, that's interesting.
Weird. And then I'd gotten like emails, like there was a character where I described her eye color and it was different. And in my head, like it's one of those awful situations where I had had a line about her contacts and her explaining how she wears different colored contacts, but it got cut off the book. But it's the kind of thing you say, you sound like you're lying. And I'm like, I would be better off just saying, I screwed up. Like,
yeah, those cut things every now and then, you create a plot hole, you don't, and because you still have the old information in your head.
Yes.
You just don't see it.
And I'll go, like, I feel like I'll go back and say, oh, this would be a moment when he'd remember this one or like think about that time. But I'm very careful. The more it goes on, the more careful I am about introducing old stories. I'm like the freewheeling times. I was just like, oh yeah, this field trip, that. And it's weird. Have you found that like with writing, you know, a character like that your approach, like, I don't know. I would spontaneously put in things that the more I get into it, the more I won't so much, or I'll think about it.
Yeah. So the interesting thing writing now book two with Frankie is, the first book before she disappeared, I just let her be because, again, it was a single title, we call it. Now that I brought her back, and I think we can all agree probably we'll see her again, I had to pay more attention. So one of the things I like, and I never know it ahead of time, but books kind of develop themes. And a lot of One Step Too Far actually has to do with fathers and friendships. And so Frankie, it makes her watching this, you know, angry father so determined to find his son kind of thing, reflect more on her childhood, which we don't know much about. And most of the scenes on the one hand kind of happened, some pivotal scenes, but this time around I was smart enough, like, okay, you've now committed to this as a fact, you better mark it down. I mean, all of these little anecdotes that start coming up, you got to remember them for later now.
<laughs> You know? Yeah, it's like being
a question. When I read Before She Disappeared, It was my conviction at the end of it that you haven't told all of Frankie's story. I mean, I've read, as you have, many standalones, and most of the time when the story is over, it's over. You know, there's no real driver to continue it. But I felt like you had just really sort of scratched Frankie's surface. There were so many things, you know, the relationship with the cop, you know, how's she going, is she going to be able to continue this self-created profession? You know, is it going to expand if she becomes known for it? Is there more she can do with it? Is it a career path? You know, whatever. And so I didn't end your book feeling as though it were a standalone. I was not at all surprised to discover that One Step Too Far was coming after it. Do you feel at this point, you know, there's still a lot about Frankie to explore that you know, deserves more books?
Well, I would say in the first book, one of the things I was very aware of, it was interesting because I read an interview you did, Caroline, about you and about Joe, where I wanted to feel very immediate. I didn't want us to know everything about Frankie. I didn't want us to go backwards in our life. I didn't want us to have all the questions answered because my sense is of Frankie is she's just so in the moment. That's kind of how she's living. That's kind of the whole point.
Because for her, the moment is so hard. Like if the moment is strenuous, you're not, it's the opposite of someone kind of laid back and reflecting.
Yeah. So I'll agree. There's tons of questions. I just didn't feel like for her, she was not the classic character we're trying to answer all of that because she's very much in the moment. Though you're right. Then there's so many questions, of course, you know, other things came up. And I think I was reading an article, Caroline, you were talking about for you, you felt it was so important to be in Joe's mindset, to be living the moments as he's seeing them. And I just find that such a compelling narrative. Like you get, there's an intimacy.
Yes, I like that. It's just the kind of storyteller, like it's the kind of writing that I just like. And also when like I had done my research casually over the years about psychopaths and sociopaths, but ultimately it's like throw it all out the window.
Like casually my research was psychopaths.
Yeah. I think that I've been at like I'm no amateur research, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. And you know, college classes, but not. But like it's like he doesn't sit there and ask if he's a psychopath or a sociopath. So like that doesn't enter into his thought process. He feels bad for himself. Like he feels like he's had the bad luck and met the bad people.
Exactly.
And I like the combination of like that self-identity and how that affects the way those tiny interactions of how he does everything. Like that for other people.
Compelling. Cause I mean, it takes a little bit, like you said, you as an author to realize, wait, I really did write a serial killer. It takes, I mean, clearly as a reader, you're like, okay, this guy is not, but you're so in his mindset, you don't get the clarity either, you know? He's just making choices the way, you know, it seems to make sense at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's part of the getting to know someone, like to like that intimacy that you're with them. Like so many moments in the book, like, oh my God, now I know what it's like to be this woman. That's a powerful feeling that you get from letting that immediacy sting you and knowing what, like, I think it's so smart, like when you reveal certain things. Of showing us like in her, like this is finally when we hear the end of a story is when she's at a very difficult moment of decision-making. And those lines that just like hit you, like when she's gonna go into that, you know, I just like sit with all throws and like, I don't wanna give anything away, but in that moment of knowing.
Is and it I like that moment for you to pull out at the end of the day? Cause Frankie, for all of her issues and insecurities, she's funnier, she's more lighthearted. She feels a little bit more like the girlfriend you'd hang out at a bar and have a drink with. So there's not necessarily that darkness or dysfunction I necessarily have to like distance myself from. You're writing a much more intense character experience.
Yes, this is, it gets a little dark at times. Yeah. And definitely like I feel like I just finished that draft a few weeks ago and I'm slowly like getting it out of my system. Just from being like, you know, when you're finishing and it's like, then it's just that 24 hour day thing of like, you can't get in there. Like, it's just in your head and you don't feel like you're, you know, you're like, it's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers with Joe. So I'm treasuring my time while they're reading it. And I'm like, okay, like maybe I'll hear from you in February, maybe in 10 months. But yeah, no, I mean, I know.
And it's interesting because that's what hiking is for me, which is how we got to One Step Too Far. Hiking is how I go and reset or even a bad writing day. And I'm just stuck and the words aren't coming. You know, it's that, I think they call it active meditation. It's getting outdoors, it's moving, it gets me thinking, it gets me problem solving, but also, you know, the bad days are the days you need to switch gears to, I mean, this time when your book's coming out, it's a little bit stressful and, you know, going out hiking, it's like part of the writing process, a very integral part of the writing process for me. How do you manage your writing angst?
I like my walks very much and my music lasting walks. And I love that feeling that when I'm walking and like, I'm curious, like, do you, on those walks when you're hiking, will you stop and make notes in your phone or do you just let it all, you don't? Yeah. So I want to like, I'll stop like, that's it. I've got it. And I love getting home. Like, no, none of this is it. And like, it's okay to go for it. Like, it's not about figuring it out. It's about like getting back to work. You know,
if it's a thought, I think it's really good. I'll repeat it to myself and almost make like a bullet point in my head, but it is interesting. Sometimes you get back to the, and you're like, okay, I know what I'm doing now. And then within, you know, half 30 minutes, you're like, no, I still know what I'm doing.
And I'm like,
imagine when I have logged some miles.
Right, but that feeling, if it gets you to get back to the computer and you have this, and you have the memory of like, there was that moment an hour ago when I had it, like, I'll have it again. You know, maybe this time it'll be real. Do you listen to music when you hike or are you out fully out in nature? Like,
I'm fully outside, but I listen to music when I write. I actually don't like the quiet house. You know, back in the day, sometimes there was playlists. But now it's more just, I will often listen to the same soundtrack or, you know, album or something over and over again, because I'm using the music to be a little bit of a white noise, but there's something very intimidating. The blank page is hard enough. Then a silent house, that's quite a combination.
That's
like ghost town or something.
I've never done that thing of like rent a house, really go off into the woods, but there's a writer, Will Dean, who like lives in the woods and nowhere. And I'm like, I don't know if I could. Because I feel like the quiet here isn't that quiet. I mean, it's louder than LA, but it's not that quiet. You know, it's New England, you know, it's like same probably where you are. And I'm like, that's quiet enough.
Because you're outside of Boston, you're
on the Cape.
Cape, yep, you're on the Cape. And I'm up in the mountains. So it's interesting because I'm from Oregon. So, and part of Wyoming was because I've hiked in the West, I know the West. And now your books are the Pacific Northwest as well.
I mean, it's such a book, a storybook place. Yeah, I always wanted to go there and it was an excuse. Yeah. So this was like your pandemic book too. So you didn't go to Wyoming, right?
I didn't get to do the specific research I would have. Normally, if I'm setting an essential place, I go and I spend time there. The good news is I was an avid hiker. So I had that experience to draw from. Yeah. I do know some West Coast hiking. And then in the end, to be honest, because of some of the danger and some of the things I was setting up, I wanted some landscapes, some kind of geographic elements that were so specific. I even made up part of the trail in Wyoming, Devil's Canyon, which I was with a local guy yesterday who's a great mountaineer. And he was like, by the time I was done reading about Devil's Canyon, I just wanted to go climb that ledge. And I'm like,
I wanted to be in a helicopter looking down on it. Yeah. Like, that's but that action was also like well done. I feel like it's the hardest part for me is the writing, the action, the like layout. So many times I'll get that note of like, where are they standing? You know, like that. And this was so visual. Does that come naturally to you or is that like part of a process?
You know, I see it all in my head. It's like, I always feel like sometimes you're like trying to type down the movie, though it's never as good. So then you're going back and trying to fine tune.
Yes. And you felt the way, I just knew from, you know, reading that you didn't get to go there, but will you go this year, do you think? Or is it now?
Yeah. I mean, I would love to go back. I'd love to do more. I'm looking at June. I really wish travel was easier right now. Let's put it that way.
Yes. Yeah. I'm like, right. Cause you last January, you had like, so this is your second pandemic.
Well, the other one I'd almost finished. I was further along when we got to lockdown. So one step too far is kind of the complete process was during this lovely time we're having in COVID.
Oh, bravo. I mean, how does that feel? Like that's, to me, that's, I don't know, to get to see people reacting so strongly to it and it's out and that's gotta be wonderful. Like you can do this in this world.
I think one of the things about books now more than ever is they become our escape. And it's interesting, one step too far, because I live in the mountains. I mean, hiking has really exploded in the last 2 years. And I think interest in it, interest in being the great outdoors, because we all need to get out of our homes and start to feel like the world's bigger again. And certainly writing a book about Wyoming, maybe that was my own way of I wanted to spend my days thinking of huge, grand, wide open spaces. It made me a little more sane.
Yes, I felt that. And I felt that reading it too. And it was like, did you think about acknowledging the the pandemic, or was it like that a no?
I couldn't do it. You know, I know as authors, we keep talking about it, and I just, it's hard enough in real life. I don't want it in the book too. And people right. hiking in masks would be weird, I think. So.
Well, that was in LA. We had the, like the mandate was outside. So you would be hiking and every, you know, it was, that was the strangest. I'm like, it's, I ended up just staying home a lot. Cause it was like, it's just too strange to be outside and see. I mean, I know it's necessary, but you know what I mean? Just,
yeah.
So did either of you read about the guy, I just was looking at the Wall Street, or maybe it was the Washington Post, about the guy that insisted on going out camping in the storm that we've just had, and it took six people to go find him and rescue him. And, you know, I think there's a certain amount of, you know, pandemic craziness. I mean, historically, if you look, there have always been, you know, crazy reactions in times of pandemic. People go nuts. And I thought this guy insisted, I mean, you could see the weather forecast, right? Yeah. And he still insisted on going camping. And that meant that six people had to, if not take a huge risk, at least had to risk themselves to go and rescue him. But we seem to have sort of lost track of the responsibility that other people accrue when we do something like that.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You know, I mean, to go back to the instigating incident in One Step Too Far, Lisa, it was because these guys got so drunk that the whole thing happened. If, you know, they hadn't packed in more booze than food to this groom's, you know, it was a bachelor party, right?
Yeah.
So if they hadn't gotten drunk,
part of this book came.
What's his name hadn't gone wandering, and then Tim hadn't, none of this would have happened.
So a lot of this book was working with search and rescue, and they will tell you, they're not often sent out to find experienced hikers. I mean, that is kind of the nature of it. All of these volunteers are coming out. Inevitably, it's humans doing stupid human tricks. And certainly in the last few years,
people can do you know anything about the Forrest Fenn thing, for example? You know, Forrest Fenn is this art dealer in Santa Fe, you know, has died, but he had loads of money and he put together, I'm trying to remember, it was like $1 million treasure chest or more of artwork and stuff. And then he went off for days and disappeared and buried it somewhere in the wilderness, you know, got it going. And eventually, not long ago, somebody found it. But what also they found fairly recently was a guy who died out there in the wilderness looking for it. And, you know, they've eventually found his remains. So, you know, what responsibility did Forrest Fenn have for doing something like this in the first place? You know, I mean, there are so many interesting questions that come up with stuff like this.
So New Hampshire started to at least, we will bill people, or the state will bill people.
Right.
If it was seen as part of your negligence, and that can even be, you didn't hike prepared. Like you didn't have water. I mean, I see people hiking sometimes in flip-flops, and we're the Boulder Granite State.
Please. We have people climbing Camelback Mountain. They've started to bill people for it too, because we have a rescue helicopter, and the hospital is right over downtown, right in downtown Scottsdale. So, you know, in the winter on a tourist day, you can see the helicopter, you know, sometimes for the people that go off with no water and flip-flops to climb a really serious mountain, and it's like 90 degrees and, you know, there we go. There's a lot of stupidity involved. But then, you know, that's true in cities too. When you look at the situation sometimes that people get into in an urban setting, you know, where
that's actually well said as well.
It doesn't have to be wilderness.
Yeah.
But I think there's some great questions going on about what responsibility we owe, not to ourselves and to our family, or not just to ourselves and our family, but what responsibility do we have to the sort of common weal? Is there even a commonwealth anymore where people think about, you know, the whole tennis thing with, you know, Djokovic was, I thought, a classic example of, you know, one person putting his own situation, you know, his own whatever against everybody else. And I thought it was really tense for Australia, you know, to try to work out what was the best thing to do in a place like that. So, you know, we have all kinds of actors doing all kinds of stuff at the moment. Yeah. It's great material for you writers. You don't even have to look for plots.
Like living in the wild, I feel like I saw a couple of days ago a real road rage incident that I haven't seen that out of where a woman went to pull in front of a guy. She was completely in the wrong. He beeped. All she had to do was wave. But instead, they got into like a drag race, a chicken. Oh. I'm like, And I knew I should pull over, but I'm like, at the same time, witnessing people just like losing it all the time. Yeah. Hard to look away, or, and it makes going out different, you know?
Yes.
Or world. Getting on a plane different. I mean, at the moment, yeah. I think you're more risk from the passengers than you are from, you know, the actual staff of the airline. Speaking of which, Lisa, you just took a really terrific trip. Did you find, I mean, I loved your Instagram posts about, you know, your trip to Antarctica. Did you, how was that for you? Was it really liberating? Were you worried? Was it a fabulous break? How did it go?
So I spent a month going to Antarctica, South Georgia and the Falklands. I love nature, animals. It's been a dream of mine to go to the Antarctic Peninsula to see the penguins. I would highly recommend it in a pandemic travel, going someplace where you saw no penguins. I mean, no people, sorry. No people was actually the perfect way of doing it. So we had to form a bubble, but once we were on the ship, we didn't see any other people at all. So it just became about ice, penguins, flora, fauna. Oh my gosh.
How close were you to the penguins?
Oh, they're just everywhere. I mean, we're trying to keep some distance. And certainly the ones that are on the nest with an egg, or when got to South Georgia, they were chicks. But the penguins are very, very busy. I kept thinking of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves and hi-ho, hi-ho. I mean, whoever's not on the nest needs to get food so they can get eat, so they can get back, so then that one can go. So it's just penguin central. And they don't care about you. They have no on-land predators.
Right.
So they're really just doing their thing, and they would like it if you got out of their way, really. So I could do their thing. We actually did a hike. We're going up a hill. It wasn't super steep, and there was this little pack of penguins we saw behind us, and they're little. And they'd probably just gotten food from the ocean, so they're coming back. And, you know, we stopped once we look back, we noticed they're like a lot closer now. I'm like, huh. We keep trekking up, you know, we have long legs, we're humans, we think we're moving, we turn around, they're like right behind us now.
Yeah.
Like, they don't even have legs. I mean, how, we're about to be passed by water penguins. I mean, I was waiting for them to have little like L.L. Bean backpacks on. I mean, they were impressive to watch in motion. They move.
Did it inspire you to think about a book based on your experience?
Travel for me is just, it's like going for the hike in the woods in a lot of ways. It's just, it's refreshing, and it's to refill the well. I don't do international thrillers, and my fun travel is generally international. So the penguins were all good for the penguins' sake.
Yeah. How wonderful.
How did you decide, like, did you know all along, like, yep, going to go see the penguins? Like, was there a list of places to go? Or
I've always wanted to go. In fact, that was my sixth continent. So now I want to go to Australia when things get better. But I like the penguins, and I like the Antarctic so much. I actually just signed up in September. I'm going to do the Arctic. So do Norway, Iceland, Greenland, and then, you know, go looking for polar bears. Which I think we really will try not to get too close to. That will be a little different than the penguin experience. What about you? Do you like to
travel? You're going to go to Svalbard, right?
I don't know all the exact stops yet. Sorry.
Well, Svalbard is the polar bear thing, but yeah, okay. That's good for you. That, you know, it sounds absolutely wonderful. So why don't we call Patrick up and see if we have questions from your many fans? Are you there, Patrick? Are you lost in the penguins?
Lost in the penguins. Well, you know, it's interesting. You have a lot of devoted fans, both of you, that are tuned in and watching. But I'm actually glad that I jumped the gun and started a few minutes early, because a number of the comments are just about how important these kinds of virtual events are to so many people all over the place. We really have fans tuning in from all over the world. So thanks, everybody.
That's great to know and great to hear. Yeah. And thank you all for being here tonight.
I think that's great. You know, when people are like, why can't you come here, there? I think that's the magic of this, that then.
It really is. I don't remember who we were talking to the other day, but all of a sudden in the middle of this, Patrick lit up and we went, what? And he said, it's our first visitor from Mongolia.
Oh my gosh, how fun.
Yeah. We have there's somebody in Zimbabwe that appears to watch on a regular basis, but It has really become international. We now have three people trained to ship internationally out of the store.
That's very cool.
Yeah, I love that.
It is. And, you know, we're doing, I mean, the thing about Zoom that's so amazing, we're going to do a program for the First Lady of Iceland, who has written a nonfiction book about women in Iceland who are doing important things. And there's an Icelandic author. So we're going to be zooming into Iceland for her. And, you know, this was an event that February 19th, I think it is. This is an event that before Zoom and the pandemic, what were the odds that Scottsdale, Arizona was going to be the host, you know, for this event? And we put together all kinds of international events. And the challenge for those are the time zones when you're trying to work out. I mean, we did an event with a woman in Perth and a woman in Dublin, and we're in the middle. And so in Dublin, it was 10 at night, it was 2 in the afternoon in Scottsdale, and it was 8 o'clock the next morning in Perth. And, you know, the negotiation involves trying to get everybody in the same place at the same moment, despite, you know, these wide-ranging time zones. But I mean, we really had some fabulous conversations that would never have been possible before.
Yep. And it's the thing I worry about the most, no matter how much time goes on. Do I have the time zone right?
Yeah.
I've had confidence with time before, but nope, not anymore. Yes.
Especially in Arizona. Let's see. Okay, so Shane has a good question for you, Lisa. He says, since they're making a Frankie Elkin TV series, how much of the creative input do you get in the series? Casting ideas for Frankie, et cetera.
Oh yeah, we didn't even get to talk about this because I have questions for you, Caroline. So the casting choice for Frankie's been made. So it's Hilary Swank in E1 Productions that optioned the movie, and Hilary Swank will co-produce, but she also wants to be Frankie Elkin. So right now they're planning on taking Before She Disappeared, the first book, and the thought is to do a limited series, much like you on Netflix. And that's as far as we've gotten. I mean, I'm thinking of 2022.
Will they next? One step too far.
They're reading it now. And I think part of it is, yes. I mean, you actually know way more, but I'm at the infancy of all of this. We just finally all signed on the dotted line. So you tell me, how does this process work, Caroline? How does it go for you?
Everyone I know, like everyone is so different. Like for me, like I'd written both books. There was like the first one's adapted. I'm like, you guys, good faith, like you make TV, I don't, so I trust you. And then I weighed in on things. And then I'd say an actor that I wanted them to look at, and they would. And then I'd be like, yeah, you were right. That's not him. And so I feel like ultimately I'm like, yeah, the people that this is what they do are just really good at knowing what works, you know? So I say, like, I feel like a fan with privileges, you know?
It sounds like it's interesting because then when you wrote the third book, you were actually now working off a little bit of the TV series.
What was tricky. Like I'd written those two together. And then when the show started, I was writing Providence, which was like such a departure. So it was an ideal, like I wrote an episode of the first season because I'm writing in the Providence world. So it was like, oh, and I'm going to play with Joe in this sphere. So when I went back a couple of years later to go back to Joe in book, it was a little bit like, oh, just that I've seen it. Like I never had, are you someone who pictures actors when you're writing? Like I just don't. I'm more like, I'll go to the coffee shop and I'm like, that's him. Like there, you know, 10 different people a day. So it was a strange thing to like work beyond. Yeah.
So I can picture Hilary Swank when we got to Zoom, which was one of the highlights of my 2021. I mean, she just looked it totally. It's like, huh, maybe I was picturing her the whole time. I don't know, but she really does look, and she has a lot of the same kind of bravado, but approachability that I picture as being Frankie.
And the listening, I feel like she has that intelligence about her too, that I can absolutely believe that she's like too sensitive for her own good in some ways, you know, like just uncontrollably listening and caring. Yeah.
Let's see, our friend Christina Estes, she says, Lisa and Caroline, what writing publishing milestones do you celebrate and how? Do you have any special rituals? Do you allow yourself one cigarette a year, or what do you do?
I'm like, I allow myself more than one. Anyway, we'll forget that. Yes, I'm curious. You, Lisa, what about you?
Oh, so, you know, that's one of the things I've changed as the years have evolved. In the beginning, I definitely celebrated things more related to publication and, you know, hitting the New York Times. Then I kind of reached this point where I realized the real accomplishment is anytime you finish a book. Because we're the authors and that's what we control. Publishing is its own crazy ride. If you start getting too hung up, well, I'm going to celebrate hitting the list and now I'm going to celebrate hitting the top 10, but now it has to be the top 5 and now it has to be number 1. You kind of start to burn yourself out. our job, Carolyn, it's my job, is to, you know, be inspired and get ourselves writing every day. And so what are the rewards for that? And for me, it's like 100 pages, because that's always the hardest for me. I just don't like the first 100 pages of a book. And then anytime a book is done, that is worthy of celebration.
I'm more and more like, I love celebrating the dones. Yes. And then like I'll realize like for a couple of like the day after, I'm like, oh yeah, not done. And I'll find that part. I'm like, oh, these 50 pages, no sense. But that's celebrate. Like, I love those celebrations. It's just like you said, like the private ones, I think, because that's when it's still yours. It's like, yeah, once it's out there, it's just a different, dangerous to celebrate external things as so much. And then the joy of celebrating when you're sitting alone in the middle of the night and you did it. It's, yeah.
How about when you get that box of finished copies? Do you still get excited, Lisa?
That is a total goosebump moment. And I will still say, when you see, walk into a bookshelf and they're actually like in a bookstore, I think I spent the first 10 years of my career convinced my mom has a warehouse just filled with Lisa Gardner novels. So it's, there's something crazy about seeing them in the wild, because we love bookstores, right? We spend all our time in bookstores. I like to spend money at the Poison Pen. So to see your own book there, it's like, oh crap, this really did happen.
Yeah, still chilled, always.
Yeah. Someone's asking, maybe you've already said it, so forgive me if you have, what platform streaming, somewhere HBO, is the show going to be on, Lisa?
We don't know. They want to make it first and then find the distributor, I think is how they call that.
Gotcha.
That sounds right.
Let's see here. Okay. Let me just jump over to YouTube real quick. Okay. Sharon wants to know, Lisa, what type of music do you listen to as background noise while writing? You mentioned soundtracks.
Yeah, I'm kind of all over the place, to tell you the truth. I do like, for Frankie, I keep doing the 80s because it just seems right for her and her generation. I guess when I was writing soundtracks, what is it? I'd seen Jagged Little Pill on Broadway, so I was obsessed with that for a while. Some radio stations, just, you know, basic top 100 or whatnot stuff.
See, what about you, Carolyn? You said you do like to listen to music, or no?
I do. I like going through phases of it, but a lot of repetition. Like you said, when it becomes white noise, then it's something to celebrate when I feel like, oh, I forgot the music was on. I stopped hearing it. But definitely in before times, I would write in coffee shops a lot and use that energy, the sound, to like break it. So writing from home so much, it's been less music for me, because I'm like, oh, I can. Yeah, there's nowhere to go.
Well, let's see, Carolyn, you have a, Liz chimes in. She said, I'm Carolyn's number one UK fan. thank you. I don't know how you do it. Genius. Yeah, so you got an enthusiastic fan.
I read a lot of Lisa to learn.
Is it ironic when people say they're your number one fan?
I love that, right? Yeah. I know, as soon as you said about the end of book rituals, I'm like, I go to a hotel and I light a cigarette and get a car accident, and then.
It's the Kathy Bates moment, right? Well, a couple of questions just about what you both are working on now. What's next for you?
What's next for you? You just finished book four, right?
Yes. So I'm working on like learning to sit upright and Zoom again.
Yeah.
And yeah, taking a breath, because I think I'll get notes soon and go back to it. So yeah, you four.
What's the title, Carolyn?
I don't know yet. And I have a few in my head, but I'm like, I think I'm too in it. Like the title I want now, I'm very well aware of, like, oh, this is me being too close to it. You know, how are you? You're not like big titles, right? Did I read that you don't like, you think you come up with different ones, or you don't like them? Or
I hardly ever figure out the title. That's like people who hire minds. And I haven't started a new project yet, because I did the Penguin thing. And then it was just in time to, you know, talk to readers about this book. And so, yeah, when the buzz of, or the you know, the lull hits after One Step Too Far. Oh yeah, you know, got to think about that.
Will you give us more Frankie?
I don't think her story's done.
I hate that. It's not a fair question. Yeah.
I never plan ahead, but I don't think her story is done yet. I will say that.
Yes.
How about any advice for both, this is for both of you, that you could give for aspiring writers?
Well, I'm active with the International Thriller Writers. In fact, I'm the chair of the author services. And I really think joining a writer's group, but all to find other people who hear voices in their head, Also, like one of the things we're doing now through the International Thriller Writers is helping come up with online critique groups. Again, finding other people to help give you motivation. Maybe since we have the everyone who talks to us is like, they're looking for community. One of the hardest things about writing, keeping yourself going, is feeling like you're alone and you don't know what you're doing. So finding some way of getting a community, keep yourself excited, to feel like you're learning your craft, to maybe build in many deadlines for yourself because, you know, there is this one person that's going to read 5 pages, you know, but start finding your people and what works for you.
Do you find that online, that Zoom and so forth is helping you with that, Lisa?
I think one of the great things for Zoom has been, especially for an organization like the International Thrill Writers, is our members are actually getting to connect more. And we're able to do more programming. So we just had an excellent panel on Sunday. S.A. Cosby of Razorblade Tears was part of it. Whereas before it was more like people got together once a year in New York, which not everyone has the time or frankly the finances to do anyway. Right. So to be able to now do all of this online program, I feel like we're getting more to our members through Zoom.
I agree. I think it democratizes it because, you know, it does allow people with limited resources of time, money, whatever it is, to participate in. I mean, we've expanded our discussion clubs as a bookstore, for example. Used to be you had to actually show up, you know, in Scottsdale at the store. And now, you know, you can live in like Charleston or somewhere. And if you can jump the time difference, you know, you can join in.
Yeah,
so
I think
there's some huge advantages. Sorry,
yeah, I think it's a great time to be getting started because there is so much more online that there was 5 years ago. It's one, you know, nice thing about this.
Well, conferences can do that too. I mean, ITW did a wonderful job, Carol. Sorry, I keep calling you. You're Lisa. She's Caroline. you know, with an online conference, and I do think that really expands your reach also. I mean, New York is so expensive and, you know, all the rest of it, so many people would never really be able to go. And I'm thinking that conferences and all are going to incorporate online, even if they have a physical gathering, even if everybody comes together in New York the first week in June for ITW. I think it's the first week in June, if I've got it right. Yep. But you can still, you know, have a video component for people who can't make the trip. It's terrific.
Are you having it in New York this June or?
I'll be in New York this June for International Thriller Writers. I certainly hope we could do. I mean, the plan is to have the conference in person. And I'm actually, one of my projects this weekend is to register. I can't wait. I miss everyone.
I've still never been. And it's one of those things I feel like the first,
I totally
it's
owe
a
you
a wonderful time. Conference. It's the last one I went to before the pandemic shut us all down. And it was July of 2019. And it was really a wonderful, wonderful experience. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So I hope we can all do it again. Patrick, is there anything else?
Let's see here. Carolyn, your fan from the UK, she says, hey, I like Lisa's books too. I've enjoyed them all. This is surreal. I couldn't sleep. And at nearly 2 a.m. I find this. Ha ha ha. Sadly, can't think of a good question. That's the beauty of these events.
Coming in.
Let's see.
You should tell people that because we don't ticket our events, these things stay live forever. And you can watch it from any time zone, anytime you want. I'm not sure when you're doing your social media, you might want to point that out, that anybody can listen to this anytime we're done, you know, it's just going to stay there. We find the long tail is actually much more, but the long tail, you can sometimes watch a geometric progression over 3 or 4 days after one of these Zoom events. There are so many people that watch it. By the next morning, it's gone up, you know, a huge amount. By the next day, it's jumped up again. And most of that's driven by your social media. You know, you telling people that they have an opportunity to watch it. Because, I mean, ours has got a finite limit to it. But I think it's really exciting to see how they, you know, they just blossom. and adding YouTube to it makes it really different. In the sense that more people, you know, people don't want to join Facebook. You don't have to belong to Facebook to watch it, but it gives you another channel. If Facebook totals, if the tech thing, you know, gets clobbered in Congress, we'll see what happens. YouTube, that would be our biggest problem, is what would happen if the platforms disappear.
Let's find another platform.
Right.
We have to find a new one.
Feels like the beginning.
Create one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be really interesting. So did that wrap us up?
Pretty much. There's one more from Bridget I'd like to ask, which is for Lisa. Will there be more Flora Dane?
Well, yeah. So this is where it gets interesting. I miss Flora too, and Dee Dee. And yeah, so again, I don't know. They're my children. I keep sending them off in the world, and then all I do is want them to come home again. So yes, highly possible. Anything's possible. Who needs a plan?
That's just amazing that you bring that many to life, you know, and then you get to choose. When they, I don't know, that's like.
Well, so for me, it's often then thinking of the crime. And then that almost is like, okay, this is the person. And then it's a great excuse to bring back a fan favorite or, you know, one of my children.
It's wonderful that you've created so many of them. It gives you a lot of choices, which, you know, must be energizing for you. I would think so. In any case, thank you, ladies. It's really been an absolute pleasure to listen to both of you. I've learned so much just watching tonight. It's been great. So
this has been so much
appreciate
fun.
Your patience. I'm sorry that we were a little late to the table, but it all worked out super well. Patrick, thank you very much.
Thank you, Patrick.
Let us wish, and don't forget that the autographed copies, our share anyway, of One Step Too Far should be with us a little bit later this week. And with any luck, when Carolyn's book publishes, we can once again get in touch with Carolyn and provide you
a great copy. I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much.
I know. It'll be really exciting. So anyway, enjoy the rest of your evening, everybody. Good night. Thank you for watching. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.